We would like to take a moment to thank our sponsor, Preborn. When a mother meets her baby on an ultrasound and hears their heartbeat, it's a divine connection, and the majority of the time, she will choose life. But she can't do it without our help. Preborn needs us, the pro-life community, to come alongside her. One ultrasound is just $28. To donate, dial #250 and say the keyword baby. Or visit preborn.com.
The feature-length documentary Culture Warrior, Don Wildman and the Battle for Decency, premiering November 11th, chronicles the life and ministry of Don Wildman. It takes you through the founding of the National Federation for Decency, what has become AFA. It's a call to stand firm for righteousness and shows how that resolve can make a huge difference in our world.
If we lose this cultural war, we're going to have a hedonistic, humanistic society.
Find out more and watch the trailer at culturewarrior.movie.
Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
I love talking about the things of God because of truth and the biblical worldview.
The U.S. Constitution obligates our government to preserve and protect the rights that our founders recognize come from God, our Creator, not our government.
I believe that Scripture in the Bible is very clear that God is the one that raised up each of you, and God has allowed us to be brought here to this specific moment in time.
This is Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
Good morning. It is Tuesday, March 25th. And if you've ever described Washington, D.C. and Congress as a circus, you are very precision. And that was evidenced as well by Democrats Jasmine Crockett and Chuck Schumer, who admitted they only care about hurting Trump, not passing legislation. And some in the Democrat Party may say, well, we prefer for those in the minority, at least in the House right now, and certainly the Democrat Party as a whole over the country, to just be obstinate figures in D.C. But it raises the question, what is the purpose of an elected representative? Is it to target a single person like we saw through some of the lawfare, or actually help the people they represent? And Town Hall says this: in a shocking admission, Representative Jasmine Crockett, a Democrat from Texas, revealed her true priorities, stating that she has little interest in passing legislation and is focused solely on taking down President Donald Trump. Her blatant disregard for productive governance highlights the growing trend among some Democrats prioritizing partisan attacks over meaningful policy work that could actually benefit the American people. It's a clear indication that for some, political vendettas are more important than delivering results for their constituents. In a recent interview, the quote-unquote squad member acknowledged that she could claim to focus on passing legislation, but argued that it would be futile, and she believes that Trump would never sign anything into law that she participated in. Instead, Crockett said she needs to preserve basic rights and focus on returning to some of the norms she claims Trump has taken away. So let's welcome in her colleague, Representative Tom Tiffany from the great state of Wisconsin, a Republican, of course. And Representative Tiffany, it's certainly not my perspective as a taxpayer, a voter, and just as an American, that we're sending people to Congress simply to have these types of partisan petty fights and to ultimately be a circus.
Jenna, that is a whole lot to unpack that you just laid out before us. And I boil it down to this is who the Democrat Party is at this point, especially what you would call the progressive, the far left wing. They are activists. They're not legislators. And I go back to my home district in northern Wisconsin, and I recall a mayor who was since defeated a year ago in her reelection, and she did a very good job of campaigning and being able to get people to vote for her, but she served only one term because she didn't want to fix potholes. She didn't want to advance the economy in her local community. It was all about activism, getting pictures with President Biden, then President Biden, making sure that the governor and one of the U.S. senators had a perch to be able to come to her community and be able to get lots of attention. It was never about advancing the cause of the people of her district. You're describing the same thing here. These are activists. They're really not interested in legislating.
That is such a great distinction. And we understand that activists can be part of the community and who can advance some of these other issues. But when we're talking about the purpose of a legislator, someone who goes to D.C., I mean, this is, or even on the state level, activism really should not be part of that job description, because when you're prioritizing opposition or action on just behalf of one particular group or cause, that really undermines the entire idea of what our founders recognized as unity in service and having a unanimous declaration that recognized that our rights are pre-political, they come from God, our creator, and it's the sole purpose, legitimate purpose of government to preserve and protect those rights. And so when you're an activist for a cause over and above recognizing that job description, then it creates this type of divisive partisanship and opposition instead of coming together under a common cause. And I think you're absolutely right seeing that this is really why our parties are at such polar opposites today. How do we perhaps try to come back from that, perhaps?
Oh, I think the voters voted for some of that. So, I mean, I would be the last person to say that I'm above the fray in terms of partisanship at times and all the rest, because I can throw a bomb or two every now and then also. But I think as a legislator, including when you're in the minority, you're always looking for opportunity to be able to advance your agenda. And those opportunities come along. Now, when you're in the minority, they're not as often as in the majority. But nonetheless, you should be looking for that. It appears that Ms. Crockett and others, I think you recognize Senator Schumer, it's really not what they're interested in doing at this point. But they have a bigger problem at this point, and that is the failure of policy. People are not buying what they're selling. You know, boys, men and girls, bathrooms, uncontrolled illegal immigration, which has been an invasion into our country, a weak foreign policy, no longer being energy independent, having homegrown energy. I mean, people rejected it back in November, and more people voted for President Trump in every single state across America. While he didn't win all of them, every single state had more voters for President Trump than he had 4 years previously. And there's a reason, because in part, they haven't fallen in love with the Republican Party, but they've rejected the Democrat Party and their extremism. And there's no other way to describe it, as we see with Tesla firebombings and judges that are trying to keep Venezuelan gang members here on the home shores of America.
And I'm speaking with Representative Tom Tiffany from the great state of Wisconsin. And, you know, when Crockett is saying she needs to preserve basic rights and focus on returning to some of these norms and all that, I mean, what rights exactly is she talking about? Because, you know, this is where I see the distinction between activism and a legislator's job of preserving actually basic rights that our founders recognize that are pre-political. And so it's not these so-called civil rights that the left has invented and in sometimes distorted as well to then shape into their activist policies. Because when we're talking about the job of legislators, I mean, certainly you can disagree on policy, you can disagree on how we best preserve and protect those rights, but rights themselves shouldn't be debatable in the sense that, you know, we're talking about whether an unborn child has a right to life, for example. I mean, the fact that that's even a debatable question these days, or whether, you know, a man can become a woman, and talking about how the left has reinvented and distorted this notion of civil rights under sexual orientation, gender identity. I mean, all of these things then go back to, as you said, a basic fundamental worldview distinction, and how the Democrat Party is focused on their agenda instead of the priority that they should, which is actually representing the people and the constituents that are Americans, that are under the very same declaration that we've had since 1776. And so when we see, Representative Tiffany, how badly the Democrat Party is having their own identity crisis, which I find hilariously ironic, how do they begin to come back from that? And how, where do you see maybe how they're going to try to shape some of these battles? Because we know that they're not just going to say, okay, yeah, we lost and America wants to actually be great again. And, you know, we recognize we were way too leftist and we were way too woke and we all of this nonsense. They're just going to try to put those policy preferences and package it in a different way.
I would suggest to you, this is exactly why the president is trying to defund the Department of Education and why Representative Massey introduced the bill to get rid of the Department of Education, of which I am a co-sponsor, because we've seen this. This is a classic case with Ms. Crockett and many others. They clearly have been in educational institutions that are not teaching them the foundational documents here in America, or at a minimum, they are distorting those foundational documents into something that are really unrecognizable. So you have this group of people that really don't understand what those founding documents mean, and that's one of the things we need to get back to, is an educational system that teaches history and teaches civics once again, and then we will be in a much better place. But I'd also say that there are some Democrats, and I see hints of it here and there, where they put their head above the firing line of the progressives, and they say, hold it, maybe we need to rethink things like buying more land that we really don't need at the federal government, that maybe we need to rethink this thing about boys playing girls' sports. Maybe we need to rethink illegal immigration. Think about Bernie Sanders over the weekend said, yeah, I do agree with President Trump in regards to illegal immigration. By the way, the same Bernie Sanders that raised his hand 5 years ago on a debate stage saying, yeah, we should just let anybody in. So he's a hypocrite as much as anybody else. But you hear them talking about that. The problem they have is the progressive left, the Tesla fire bombers, the people that come out and rant at town halls and will not allow a congressman to exercise a town hall in a reasonable, rational manner. Those people stand atop the ramparts of the progressive left, and they will shoot down anybody, a Democrat as much as a Republican, that casts opinions that are different than their mindset.
So well said. And this is why we need to be paying attention in all states to elections, to primaries, and perhaps choose wisely and elect legislators who care about governing instead of activists who care about their own agenda. But in the last few minutes I have with you, Representative Tom Tiffany, I also want to get your take on the Wisconsin Supreme Court election, speaking about activists over perhaps originalists on the judiciary side. This election is set for a week from today and could shift, has the implication of shifting the balance between Republicans versus Democrats, or more conservatives versus liberals, perhaps is a better way to characterize it. And so this has gotten national attention because of the potential implications for the congressional races and the House majority moving forward.
Yes, it does have national implications, and it could be the biggest race of 2025 here nationally, though it is just in our state of Wisconsin. And what this is going to do is determine the makeup of the Wisconsin Supreme Court. It's a seven-member court. A liberal just retired, and the vote to replace her is going on next Tuesday in 1 week. So it's a 3-3 court hanging in the balance. Is it going to go liberal or conservative? And they showed their colors when the liberals have held the court for the last 2 years, when, for example, they created a bill, a policy out of thin air without any legislative passage of a bill to allow ballot drop boxes to be used anywhere in Wisconsin. So they just created it out of thin air. They're going to do this in so many different ways, shapes, and forms. But the reason this is important nationally, and why, if anyone's listening who's in Wisconsin at this point, you've got to vote in next week. And by the way, you can go down to your town or city clerk's office today and vote, because we have 2 weeks of early voting here leading up to next Tuesday. I already voted 1 week ago. You need to get out there and vote, because they have said the quiet part out loud. The liberal candidate said 2 months ago, to a group of liberal donors, mega donors, like George Soros and others, we could change the map in Wisconsin, the federal map, and get rid of two Republicans out of the state of Wisconsin. Hakeem Jeffries just said the same thing in the last couple days in an interview. Hey, Wisconsin's really important. Get out and vote because we could pick up two seats. Why is that important? Look at some of the votes that we've had over the last month where we've won by two votes. You know, critical bills like the continuing resolution, like the budget resolution, they are winning by just a couple votes. If we lose two, those would be tie votes and these bills would not pass. Our razor-thin majority is at stake in Wisconsin.
And that has the absolute potential to impact, as you mentioned, legislation and the entire Trump mandate and the agenda for codifying some of these executive orders into law for 2026 and beyond. And I've been saying for a while, Representative Tiffany, that the momentum coming out of the 2024 election for that Trump mandate needs to be built upon and increase that momentum so that hopefully there's a stronger majority of conservatives, whether Republican or Democrat, anybody will actually vote for the conservative agenda, and as well as in the Senate, and to get hopefully perhaps even a filibuster proof majority there. And so this has the potential to be the difference between codifying those executive orders and impacting the future beyond just these 4 years, or completely thwarting it and bringing the administration to a halt in terms of what the executive branch can accomplish when we don't have the partnership in Congress. So let's talk for just a moment about gerrymandering and how this could even be accomplished when the Democrats are so open about this. I mean, that's clearly just playing partisan politics to try to get rid of Republican seats in favor of Democrat seats. If this were the other way around and Republicans were talking about doing that, Democrats would be crying foul. So who ultimately decides this? Well, probably the Wisconsin Supreme Court, right?
That is correct. The Wisconsin Supreme Court will decide this, and as the judicial candidate on the liberal progressive side has said to donors, this is at stake. She has clearly signaled that they will take up these maps and redraw them. And what they'll do is they'll split Madison, they'll split Milwaukee, and they'll pick up two seats that way. If people want to see a really good gerrymander by the Democrats, take a look at our neighbor to the south in Illinois, which we're going to become like Illinois if we get if we don't get the right candidate here. Our candidate is a man named Brad Schimmel, who's a former attorney general, really good judge on the circuit court bench. Illinois is 14-3. 14-3 Democrats, and it's a 55-45 Democrat state. That is what they're going to do. And you look at some of those districts that snake through Illinois, you're going to see the same thing happen here in Wisconsin. But make no doubt about it, they are going to, if they get the majority back, the Democrats do, they're going to impeach Donald Trump. That's the first thing that they're going to do. We want to have a successful 4 years of President Trump, not just 2 years.
Absolutely. Well said. Well, Representative Tom Tiffany, thank you so much. We'll have to take a break right now, but always appreciate your time and your commentary and your passion for actually helping represent the people in your district. And we really appreciate you. We're praying for you and everyone else on Capitol Hill here at the AFR family. So we will be right back with more here on Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back. So apparently yesterday, an Atlantic reporter was added on to a very high-profile Signal group chat with the Trump administration, talking about a lot of national security issues, among other things. Here's Daily Wire reporter Tim Pierce on that.
The chat included high-ranking Trump officials such as Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth, National Security Advisor Michael Waltz, and Vice President J.D. Vance. Messages to the group contained sensitive operational details before the attacks. The Atlantic's Jeffrey Goldberg says he received a signal connection request from a user identified as Michael Waltz. Experts warn that the use of an unsecured app for classified planning may have violated federal law and endangered national security. The White House said Goldberg's addition was an inadvertent error and called the thread a demonstration of the deep and thoughtful policy coordination between senior officials.
So let's welcome in Josh Hammer, who is an editor-at-large for Newsweek, host of The Josh Hammer Show, and all-around prolific writer and author. So, Josh, good morning. And, you know, is this really kind of a much ado about nothing here? Because, you know, when I worked in D.C. and when I was working on the campaign side and for Trump, I mean, everybody in government uses Signal, and it really isn't that big of a deal.
Good morning, Jana. Well, using Signal is not itself a massive big deal. I'm not particularly concerned about the fact that high-ranking government officials are using Signal. I am deeply concerned by the fact, obviously, that Jeffrey Goldberg was somehow added to this Signal group. I mean, the best thing you can possibly say about that, the best way to possibly spin that, is catastrophic incompetence, and that's the best-case scenario. The worst-case scenario is quite a bit darker than that. I do suspect that it probably is just catastrophic incompetence, but that's really bad. I mean, we shouldn't mince words. That's a massive unforced error. I mean, I am someone who's been blocked on social media by Jeffrey Goldberg for over a decade because he is a very far-left journalist. He is someone who has been in the tank for Barack Obama and Joe Biden, for elite Democrats, for a very, very long time now. And it's inexcusable. I mean, it's inexcusable for any editor, writer, journalist to be added to a group chat with the Vice President of the United States and the National Security Advisor. I mean, it would be inexcusable for me to be added to that, frankly. So, I mean, you compound that by orders of magnitude, and it's doubly, triply, quadruply, quintuply, et cetera, inexcusable for someone like Jeffrey Goldberg to get added. So that is a massive, massive mistake. I do not think it serves any purpose. It does no one good, I think, to downplay the magnitude of that mistake. But the mere fact that they're using Signal in the first place doesn't bother me, but surely we have to do whatever we can to try to make sure that something like this, Jenna, does not happen again.
Yeah, well, obviously it was a massive mistake to add a reporter, but ethically, and you write for Newsweek, you are a journalist, you know, you've been obviously around stories in D.C. and, you know, other things for a long time here. But what is the ethical obligation of the reporter? Because, in the attorney world, if you're sent something accidentally by, opposing counsel, and, you know, and obviously this has national security implications. So, you know, this is my analogy only goes so far. But if you're sent something by opposing counsel, you have an ethical obligation to tell them about it and to send it back and to not actually use it, because you recognize that sometimes, unfortunately, those types of unforced errors happen. And so instead of doing the ethical thing, in my view, which would have been just letting them know and then exiting the chat, Goldberg goes and screenshots this and releases the whole thread just for clicks. I mean, I think regardless of what else happens, he should be blackballed by the White House from here to eternity, which is what I posted on my X thread. But really, what makes this any different from someone, say, like a Chelsea Manning, who is releasing things that are classified, and at this level, certainly that is, to the public without authorization?
I'm not sure how big of a difference there is, to be honest with you. I mean, look, if he had gone ahead and released this prior to the announcement, and the commencement of the strikes against the Houthis in Yemen, then that's borderline grounds for treason. I mean, if he had done it before the strikes, after the strikes, it's not treasonous necessarily. I mean, that would be overstating the case, I think, to be honest with you. But it is. It's extraordinarily unethical behavior. But again, it can only be understood by the fact that Jeffrey Goldberg is a career left-wing sycophant. Jeffrey Goldberg, and I'm allowed to say this just because I obviously am Jewish myself, as someone who has a very Jewish-sounding last name, Goldberg, Jeffrey Goldberg personally took it upon himself during the Barack Obama administration to basically be the voice of the Iran nuclear deal. Barack Obama basically used Jeffrey Goldberg as kind of his token court Jew to basically try to sell his catastrophic Iran nuclear deal to the masses. In fact, it was for me repeatedly calling him Barack Obama's court Jew that Jeffrey Goldberg decided maybe 10 years ago or so to finally block me on social media. So he's a bad faith actor. He is a bad faith, very left-wing, in-the-tank for the Democrats actor. So the entire purpose of him screenshotting this in Denver and writing this article and causing this whole national hullabaloo is really nothing less than his attempt to embarrass the Trump administration and try to undermine its foreign policy. I think that's pretty clearly what's going on here. Seems to me to be extraordinarily unethical, but again, that's because Jeffrey Goldberg is a left-wing hack.
And well said, and I couldn't agree more. And this is why I don't think personally, you know, and we only have very little information right now as far as how this actually happened. But, you know, this wasn't a reporter that is in the White House pool, that is somebody that the White House frequently relies on for, you know, maybe background information ahead of a story or, you know, anything that is remotely collegial sort of operations with journalists that cover the White House. And so for this particular reporter who is a bad faith actor, who would probably, if you're a predicting or betting sort of person, you would say, out of all of the people in D.C. covering this, who would be likely to not do the ethical thing? You might think of someone like Goldberg. And so to me, it seems much more likely that instead of a massive mistake, this is somebody else in that group chat. And we don't know how many people were involved exactly who was in this group chat, which is a whole other potential problem, by the way. But I think it's a lot more likely that someone else in the group chat who had legitimate access added him because, you know, as somebody who's used Signal myself, it's not as easy as it is on, say, iMessage or other types of messaging apps to add somebody to an existing group chat on Signal. I mean, for that to just be, that's a little difficult. So if that suspicion is right, hypothetically, what does that say about potentially other people and bad actors within the administration? I mean, this goes back to, I think, the first administration.
Yeah, I probably don't buy that, to be honest with you. As I was saying earlier, I do think that this is probably just gross incompetence. There's a principle in general logic called Hanlon's razor that basically says you should not attribute to malice, which can be ascribed to just rank incompetence. And I think that that's a general good rule for life. If there is an explanation on grounds of incompetence, that probably has your rebuttable presumption of being correct unless proven otherwise. So it's possible that there's someone here, and who knows, again, how many people were in this particular group chat. You could be talking dozens, hundreds, who knows. It's possible that someone has Jeffrey Goldberg as a source, which, yes, that would be very problematic because, again, he is a bad faith actor and he should not be given any kind of access at all to this administration there. But my operating presumption for now is that this is just gross incompetence. The operating theory, from what I can glean from what I've read thus far, is that he was likely accidentally added because he shares the same initials as someone else who should have been added to the chat there. That strikes us as so dumb to be like borderline impossible. But I mean, this is government we're talking about there. Government does a lot of dumb stuff, make a lot of dumb mistakes.
Unfortunately, and that's why we need Doge, I think, to come in and perhaps root out some of that waste and incompetence otherwise. But let's talk about the substance now of what actually was leaked. What's going on in foreign policy in the world? I mean, obviously, you have now proof that at least, you know, Trump administration officials are talking to each other. They are coordinating. I mean, that's perhaps a silver lining about all of this. But this, in the substance of the text messages, what's going on in Yemen, also what's going on further in the Middle East with, you know, Israel and Hamas. What's your view overall on where the Trump administration and the United States is positioned and how we are, I don't know, either interfering, helping? How would you characterize it?
Well, I think it's not a surprise to say that there are mixed voices right now in the administration. We saw that a little bit in the group chat itself, according to Jeffrey Goldberg's screenshots, at least. When it comes to the level of specific U.S. involvement that is appropriate, I personally think the Trump administration is correct to start taking the Houthi issue into its own hands for the very simple fact that the U.S. has a pretty clear interest when it comes to the Red Sea itself as it comes to an international waterway. I mean, the Red Sea is single-handedly responsible for 10 to 20% of global commerce, give or take there. And you can't have a situation where the United States is having U.S. flagged commercial or private ships or even military ships that are being held hostage by radical 21st century Muslim pirates. And that's essentially what we've had for the past year and a half there. So I think the Trump administration is correct at the end of the day to try to take the Houthi issue into its own hands, at least working closely with our regional partners, Israel, maybe some of the more moderate Sunni Arab states as well, Saudis, Emiratis, and so forth there. So I think they're correct on the Houthi issue. Look, the real issue potentially for this second Trump administration when it comes to the Middle East is going to be the Iran issue. And Pete Hegseth on Mark Levin's Fox News show the other night was extraordinarily clear. He was very, very kind of dead serious looking into the camera, saying that it is this administration's policy that Iran will not get a nuclear weapon, period, full stop, end of story. I do think that you have some other voices in the administration that do not necessarily care if Iran gets a nuclear weapon, as long as there is some amorphous verification regime or something along those lines. Those are the words actually that Steve Witkoff himself used in his appearance with Tucker Carlson on Friday, if I'm not mistaken there. So there are some competing voices on the Iran issue. Personally, Jenna, I have never once called in my entire life for the United States to directly bomb Iran's nuclear sites itself. That's not my stance. I do think that the Trump administration had it right the first time when it came to these crippling sanctions, this general notion of a maximum pressure campaign, effectively trying to provide cover for the Iranian people to ideally take matters into their own hands and to send this genuinely evil regime into the ash heap of history there. So I'm heartened by some of what the Trump administration has already done when it comes to putting back in some of these crippling sanctions that the Biden administration has taken out. Beyond that, I think all the United States really ought to be doing at this exact time in the region is just supporting Israel, because Israel is not just America's closest ally in the Middle East, but Israel is the only country in the Middle East for whom their national interest when it comes to all these security-related matters is effectively the exact same as the American national interest. If you want to advance the American national interest in the Middle East, which I obviously do, one of the best bang for your buck ways to do that in terms of ROI, return on investment, is basically just to defend and support Israel, because they're effectively the folks on the ground who are there securing all of our Western interests basically on our behalf.
I'm speaking with Josh Hammer, who's the editor at large for Newsweek, host of The Josh Hammer Show, and has a brand new book out that you absolutely need to get. And Josh, before I let you go, let's also turn to the legal issues potentially surrounding these leaked texts. Eric Geller, who is another Twitter voice, a freelance cybersecurity reporter, so, you know, not exactly someone who may be reliable on this topic, but he posted some commentary that said some of the issues that may arise out of this is that Signal isn't an approved government platform for classified info. Anyone remember Hillary's emails? Signal's disappearing messages feature was enabled an apparent violation of federal records laws, and including a journalist in the group constitutes leaking, like we discussed. So other than for potential ramifications on Goldberg, what about, you know, those other two issues about disappearing text messages and that Signal isn't an approved platform?
We'll see how it plays out. Without naming names, Jenna, I can tell you that, you know, I mean, I have a lot of friends who work in Washington, D.C. I have a number of friends who work in Congress, who work in the executive branch and so forth there. I don't think it's going to exactly be a shock to the American people that a lot of people in government use a lot of messaging apps, whether it's WhatsApp, Signal, or so forth, that maybe are not on the government's quote-unquote approved list. So this is not exactly a shocking revelation. If someone wants to initiate some sort of hearing or legal proceeding, I guess, have at it. I personally am just not really particularly concerned about that, to be honest with you. I'm extremely concerned about the fact that a left-wing hack like Jeffrey Goldberg was added to the list, but I'm really not particularly concerned about any kind of violation of government policy when it comes to using an app like Signal in the first place.
Yeah, and I think that's a fair distinction to say, you know, more so than using the app itself and texting, because, you know, hey, people text. That's just the reality of where we're at with technology in 2025. You know, maybe not Donald Trump, but at least not in his first term. I've heard that he's doing a little more texting these days. But other than that, it is more around the circumstances of exactly what happened on this incident and why and how this particular reporter was added. So I think that that's I think you're right that that's probably more of the concern, and that the White House really needs to get to the bottom of whether this was a giant mistake, how that happened, whether this was something more nefarious, they're being undermined, and maybe how to prevent that in the future. But Josh Hammer, always appreciate your time, your expertise, and your comments this morning. So tell us quickly in the last minute about your book, where people can get it.
Sure. So the new book is called Israel and Civilization, The Fate of the Jewish Nation and the Destiny of the West. It reached a high gen of number 3 on all of Amazon last week, so it's off to a really strong start.
Congrats.
Praise be to God for that. The book, Jen, is calling for a joint Jewish-Christian ecumenical biblical restoration. That really is the purpose of this book. It's basically calling on Jews and Christians to lock arms and stand shoulder to shoulder like never before, because without the Bible and without Scripture and without God, Jenna, we ultimately are nothing. We have to stand for our own biblical inheritance and be proud of that biblical inheritance. Without that biblical inheritance, we will not be able to defeat the forces of wokeism, Islamism, and global neoliberalism that's threatening to destroy. So that's the basic premise of the book, Israel and Civilization. You can check it out on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, or wherever you get your books.
Excellent. As we celebrate the many pro-life victories going forward, we rejoice. Preborn's network of clinics have a unique opportunity to advance even further without political persecution. But what does this look like? Preborn is the greatest threat to the abortion industry by rescuing on average 200 babies' lives a day, and they are putting a serious dent into the abortion holocaust. But there are still thousands of babies who are slain daily, and Preborn's goal is to rescue them all. With the help of the pro-life community, meaning you and me, we can save so many more. Please join us in saving all of these precious lives. The ultrasound is the game changer. Once a mother hears that precious heartbeat, she is twice as likely to choose life. If you consider yourself pro-life, we need your help. One ultrasound is just $28. 5 ultrasounds are $140. $5,000 sponsors ultrasounds for the entire Preborn network for an entire day. So how many lives can you save? Every child is a beautiful gift from God, so please join this cause. To donate securely, please dial #250 and say the keyword baby. That's #250 baby, or visit preborn.com/AFR. That's preborn.com/AFR.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back. And the Honorable Mike Huckabee's Senate confirmation hearing for the position of U.S. Ambassador to Israel starts today at 10 a.m. Eastern. So you can watch that hearing that will be in front of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee starting at 10 a.m. Eastern. I know CBN News and probably a variety of other outlets and YouTube streams and all of that will carry that. And so be praying for that confirmation hearing. Mike Huckabee is a really great choice, I think, for ambassador to Israel. And it's interesting that the Democrats, some like Jerry Nadler, are opposing Mike Huckabee's ambassadorship. But it just goes to show how the Democrats are always the opposition party and opposing things that really shouldn't be that controversial. I mean, this is not a pick that it should be that controversial. But, you know, that's the way that the circus works, right? So be praying for that. Well, let's turn to the economy and also MAHA, because as a lot of American families are looking to see how the Make America Healthy Again movement combats a lot of chronic disease, there is a lot of growing financial burdens on prescription drug costs. And so as families look for ways to cut spending, Big Pharma continues to increase prescription drugs. So let's welcome in Emily Lampkin of the Pharmaceutical Reform Alliance. And so, Emily, good morning. And this is a growing problem for the soaring prescription drug costs and the impacts to families. So what's your best advice?
Thanks, Jenna, for having me. My first thought is exactly what you laid out. This is actually a twofer opportunity for President Trump, both to make America more affordable and make America more healthy again. 50% of women in this country manage their household budget, and that's a number that continues to grow. And 30% cannot afford their prescription drugs. We need a sense of urgency in D.C. to address this problem. This year already, Big Pharma has raised the price on more than 800 medications. Those are medications already on the market. They will claim that they need that money in order to reinvest in research and development, yet less than a fifth of their spend goes to research and development. So the big question is, where is all the money going and why are we doing this on the backs of Americans?
And, you know, I'm of the view that America is overprescribed, and this is, you know, Big Pharma is a consumer-oriented industry to try to get more drugs on the market and to increase those prices because it's all for profit. And so this kind of dual opportunity, as we're describing, is an opportunity to combat chronic disease, get people off of a lot of prescription medications while the medications that are actually necessary, and there are a lot of those, make those more affordable. And as I was talking to another guest earlier this week on the program that was saying, you know, the MAHA agenda and the policy hasn't really been particularized and sort of distilled into a briefing packet, a white paper, you know, that kind of thing. And so from the HHS department perspective, how should the Trump administration focus on prescription drugs and also the pricing?
Good question. The first thing I know from spending time with women all over the country, thousands of them every year, is they truthfully believe, and it's legitimate, they get up every morning, take care of their families, go to work. They elect officials that they expect to come to this town and do their job. How they go about lowering drug prices, they're less concerned about than you need to do your job. I do mine, you need to do yours. We do need to lower the cost, and we need to get to the bottom of why this is happening. There's a number of reasons. You know, first of all, President Trump said recently in an interview that the system is unfair and it's unfair to Americans. And that's completely true. In part, Big Pharma is cheating and gaming our patent system, which needs to be addressed. Just like you, I'm a capitalist. I believe in free markets. I believe they should be able to make a profit. But their profit margins are more than twice that of S&P 500 companies. And just to give you a sense of how they're doing this by putting Americans last. About 25 million Americans suffer from asthma. About 20% of those are children. Just one company alone charges Americans more than 30 times more for an inhaler that they sell to Germans for $9. We've got to get to the bottom of why this is happening, and we can all understand the real impact it has on American families and the choices they have to make.
And I'm speaking with Emily Lamkin of the Pharmaceutical Reform Alliance. And according to an article that I was reading earlier, Emily, this actually really surprised me that the United States, well, we know, has the highest per capita prescription drug spending and has had that for more than a decade. It's now reached an average of over $1,400 per American in 2021. I mean, that's a significant number, and that's even with people who get prescriptions when they have access to healthcare and they have insurance and all of that. I mean, so even with insurance helping to lower some of those drug prices, I mean, the cost of healthcare in America is exorbitant. And I'm not an advocate for single payer. I think that would have disastrous implications. We see how that has happened in Europe and even Canada, and some of the accessibility to providers, you know, all of those other consequences and collateral consequences. But this type of issue as well, I mean, can this also be solved when we're talking about healthcare and affordability overall when we look at insurance?
As I mentioned, the solution, all the solutions need to, potential solutions need to be out there, and there needs to be a review of them. And again, there needs to be a sense of urgency. But you touched on something important, the price of prescription drugs for individuals in this country. And part of what Big Pharma is doing is making them unpredictable. So a medicine, for example, that you would spend $200 for 1 week, you may go back and it's $250 or $300 the next week, and there is no rhyme or reason. And there is no explanation given to Americans, and they have no ability to do anything other than to either forego taking the prescription drugs or buy it at a higher cost. So how do you manage a household income when you don't even know what the changes are coming or why? And we've got an entire industry that has no explanation other than profit margins for why the cost of medicines, and especially as we understand with moms, it's asthma medicine, it's ADHD medicine, it's, you know, allergic reaction medicines, and the prices continue to rise with no rhyme and reason.
That's a really interesting observation as well, that, you know, you go and if you get a prescription or even, you know, at times over-the-counter medications and all of that, it seems like the prices just rise and fall as arbitrarily as airline tickets. And so who controls this and why do they fluctuate so much?
Big Pharma does, and we don't have a real answer on it, except they can, and they're doing this on the backs of Americans, not other countries. They're putting America last, and there is great hope among Americans that electing President Trump and a new Congress will allow Americans to be put first and Americans first in being able to afford their prescription medicine.
So then, Emily, what is Congress doing at this point, or are they, to potentially address the prescription costs? I mean, and on the congressional side, not necessarily everything that RFK Jr. is doing on HHS and the executive, but it's Congress looking at this in real time when we now have the Trump mandate?
So the answer is yes and no. So the answer is yes, they're looking at it. There's been recent hearings, there's discussions. But as I mentioned, there is no sense of urgency about this. And there needs to be a sense of urgency, and it needs to come quickly. As the president said, it's unfair. And as you mentioned, when you're talking about those prices, that's a significant part of a family's budget. So this is something that must be addressed. It gets more and more acute all the time. And so there's solutions that are needed, and they need to come quickly.
Yeah. So in a best case scenario, what should Congress be doing to address these problems most effectively and most imminently?
So I am hesitant to provide my recommendations. The Pharma Reform Alliance knows there needs to be change, but wants to be open about what those opportunities may be. But I do think everybody needs to be called to task here, and everybody needs to be part of the solution. By everybody, I mean both Congress and the President and RFK Jr. to come up with a solution. And as I mentioned before, there's a number of clear concerns here that can be addressed. The gaming of the patent system, for one. Another is, you know, that there's no rhyme or reason to the rising costs of prescriptions. Again, the response that continues to come back from Big Pharma is, oh, we have to do this. This is how we pay for research and development. Big supporter of research and development. They have they are making life-changing decisions every day by providing new medications and providing and addressing chronic illnesses for Americans. But if they've raised the price of 800 medications already this year that are already on the market, there's a lot more to this in terms of monopolistic practices in that industry that we just don't see in other industries in this country.
Yeah, that is an excellent point as well, that, you know, Big Pharma tends to have this type of monopoly, and they do this under the guise of research and development, as you mentioned, but there's not the same type of competition, even when you're talking about, you know, maybe the generic form and some of these things as we do see in other industries. And so it's really interesting to contemplate, you know, the special interest here, why exactly this is. But hopefully, Emily, that the HHS and also Congress will prioritize this, because as we've seen over the last several months, Trump can focus on quite a few things while prioritizing, you know, everything that he needs to, but, you know, have kind of his hand in everything. And so I think that Congress can walk and chew gum as well, and hopefully they'll focus on some of these priorities as well. So Emily Lamkin, Pharmaceutical Reform Alliance, thanks so very much for your time and comments this morning. And as always, listeners can reach me and my team, Jenna, at AFR.net.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast may not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.
We'd like to thank our sponsors, including Preborn. Preborn has rescued over 200,000 babies from abortion, and every day their network clinics rescue 200 babies' lives. Will you join Preborn in loving and supporting young moms in crisis? Save a life today. Go to preborn.com.